Hey, everybody. Welcome to the No Film School podcast for the week of July 7th, 2022. I'm Charles Hayne. I'm a filmmaker. I'm here with Todd Blankenship, cinematographer.
Hey, what's up, everyone?
Gigi Hawkins, filmmaker.
Hello there.
And George Edelman, editor-in-chief of No Film School.
Hello.
And this week, we're going to be talking about Tom Cruise's thoughts on the possibility of a Top Gun sequel way back in 1989. We are going to be talking about James Cameron's thoughts on people's opinions about his work and whether he cares. Spoiler, no, he does not. We're going to be talking about building community through screening series and backyards. In tech news, we're going to be talking about the Lawa Nanomorphs a little bit more because Todd was curious and wasn't on the episode last week. So, like, we'll do that at the end. So if you're like, I don't need to hear more about these lenses, you can stop. But if you're like, ooh, I did want to know more and I bet Todd has good questions, you can stick around. And that'll be this week.
It's a bit of pressure, but I'll try.
I mean, you have great questions.
Okay,
good. You also have good answers. You have many things.
Oh man, we're starting out with the compliments. I like this.
Yeah, this is. I mean, I love everyone on this podcast. It's a great time. So that's this week on the No Film School podcast. You know, we mostly talk about more indie fare on this podcast. Top Gun Maverick is like the opposite of indie fare. It is like the highest grossing and the biggest budget and the least nuanced. But I saw it. It was good. I don't know anyone who has seen it who does not think it was good. Like, even the indiest of indie people I know is like, yeah, I saw it with my dad. It's good. You can't help it.
Such a dad movie, but it's yeah. But it's also it's made a bill, right? Or it's like it's doing amazingly
well.
Remember
when a bill just meant $100? Like, your buddy would be like, oh yeah.
No,
it means an actual billion. But you found this amazing quote in Playboy, George. You were flipping through some vintage Playboy at a garage sale.
I wish it was me flipping through Playboys, but it's not. It's John Frankensteiner at J Frankensteiner on Twitter. This is one of my favorite Twitter.
I'm sorry, I have to be a pedant. It's vintage Playboy. It's not Playboys, plural. It's Playboy. That's the plural.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
I thought that would actually be funny. It wasn't funny, so we should cut the whole thing out. Like, you can't be a grammar pedant about fucking Playboy.
So, a flock of Playboy is just Playboy?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's singular.
I made it even worse, Charles.
Or play boost.
Play beast. Sorry, let's move on.
I just want to beat the ghost of Hugh Hefner into the ground. I just want to make sure he is like spinning in his grave. Anyway.
It's only articles now, right? Is that where they stand? So
you didn't know he died?
I didn't either.
He died right before the Me Too thing happened, and there were all these theories that like he had cast some protective spell over Hollywood, and when he died is when all the stories came out.
Yeah, I believe that.
He's also the saddest human being I've ever met in my entire life.
You
met him?
Yeah, I did a shoot at the Playboy Mansion. It was one of those things early in my career. Some journalist from The Guardian, whose whole shtick was what a prude she was, like, she was really cool, but like her shtick was like, wouldn't it be ridiculous if I went to these places and I'd be like the uncomfortable English woman? She was in L.A., and she got the Playboy Mansion to agree to let her go. And so she called everybody she knew in LA and was like, hey, do you know any camera people who would like come shoot me be awkward at the Playboy Mansion? And I was and a friend of mine was English, asked me if I would do it. I was like, fuck yeah. And 4 hours later, I was at the Playboy Mansion.
Seeing how sad Hugh Hefner was.
It was like he like wandered around in he's an old man wandering around the house in pajamas and a bathrobe at like 4 PM. And it was just like, so sad. All the playmates were super nice. Everybody else who was there was really nice. I met the projectionist. He was a really cool guy because they have like an in-house movie theater. But then every once in a while, like Hugh Hefner would wander by and you're like, oh God, like
he's just a grandpa. He's just an old man.
No, he's way sadder than a grandpa. Cause
the heyday was probably like 5 decades prior.
But I don't even think he was having fun.
Whatever
in the
it was.
Like, I think he was always a man pretending to be something else. And I think there's nothing sadder than pretending to be something you're not. And I think he was always pretending to be someone he wasn't. And we talked to the chef for a while, and like, he eats the same thing every day. And it's like a hard-boiled egg. And like, And oh I'm like, God. Dude, you're not even in, like, it was just, it was like, ugh. But the journalist lady was super fun and we got to tour the zoo and the zoo's quite nice there. Anyway.
You got, don't you just love, stories. I love the stories you get in this industry, just the weird things that happens to you.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Only because I work in film did I get to visit the Playboy Mansion and see Hugh Hefner on a Tuesday afternoon be all sad.
Yeah, yeah. You know he eats hard boiled eggs and is
eight. Past tense.
Eight. Yeah. Oh, yes, yes. He's no longer eating.
So it's true though. Gun. I mean, you stick around. Like I shot some interviews. I think I did Ray. I did one where I was at Ray Bradbury's house, and I did one where I was at Corbin Ball's house. I did some weird, you know, just and they weren't weird. They were just like shooting interview stuff. But yeah, when you kick around, you get some interesting. You get to watch.
I hear old Gore Vidal was a little bit depressed, but
he was barely hanging like, on. But interesting.
But old Ray Bradbury must have been having a blast, right?
Beautiful, full of life, like awesome, inspiring to see. You know,
nerds, just embrace that you're a nerd, love yourself for being a nerd, let yourself be a nerd, love your shit. Yeah, God bless. Anyway, you were saying about reading old Playboys in your neighbor's garage. This story,
right? That's where we were. This follow on Twitter, I'm gonna give this man a shout out one way or another. John Frankensteiner is the name, but it's Jay Frankensteiner. He's really fun. He does a lot of film-related stuff or all film-related stuff. If you're listening, I've asked him to do stuff with No Film School. He's just too busy, but he's awesome. Anyway, he digs up all these great quotes. He dug up this one. He said, found this amusing part of a 1990 Tom Cruise interview. Playboy, question. Born on the 4th of July is also the flip side of Top Gun, which is essentially war by Nintendo game and a paean to blind patriotism. Cruise's answer. Okay, some people felt that Top Gun was a right-wing film to promote the Navy, and a lot of kids loved it. But I want the kids to know that's not the way war is. The Top Gun was just an amusement park ride, a fun film with a PG-13 rating that was not supposed to be reality, and that's why I didn't go on and make Top Gun 2 and 3 and 4 and 5. That would have been irresponsible. So what's fascinating about...
Before we talk about this, can I just commend you on your performance? I felt like there was a lot of nuance. Like you lean into a Cruise impersonation, but I felt like you gave that quote like a lot of, I liked it.
I considered trying to do Cruise, but then I was like, I don't even know what that is. It's more in the eyes and the crazy unblinking stare. But like, anyway, Tom Cruise, obviously this is a bit of a gotcha, like historically, because he made Top Gun Maverick. Although the joke is he didn't make Top Gun 2. He made Top Gun Maverick. But either way, what's fun about this quote to me is, and the reason I wanted to talk to you guys about it on the podcast and for our readers, because you're right, Charles, Top Gun Maverick is not really super significant. Although we had the editor on the podcast. It's a great interview. But it's not like in terms of significance of the film as a whole to, you know, the indie filmmaker. However, man, has the industry changed. Tom Cruise was a major star then. He's a major star now. And at that time, not only doing a movie like Born on the 4th of July, which is extremely political film, but talking about it in a context with Top Gun, his mainstream fare, as like, yeah, that's fun, that's for the kids. This is serious. This is the serious work. Like, that's not the world we live in anymore. Can you even imagine him addressing the very real fact that Top Gun Maverick has a very strong relationship to our military industrial complex and certain ideologies? Like, he would never talk about that now. Now, maybe it's because Scientology has cleansed him of these kinds of concerns. I don't know. But either way, that's a very different place in the late 1980s or early 1990s that he was at, both as like what a movie, even if you look at it from like what a movie star's career was then. You made like your Top Guns, but you were trying to be a guy who made movies like Born on the 4th of July. You were trying to be somebody who was making these serious movies where you were going to win an award and be taken seriously as an actor. Like now, just open big. Like that's become way more. I mean, yes, there are lots of filmmakers and actors who are chasing, you know, prestige in a different way. But Tom Cruise literally was just like, I just want to make a movie that gets people into theaters. That's all I want to do anymore. And mission accomplished, right? So things have changed a lot. That, to me, that's the crazy part. But I want to know what you guys think, if you agree or disagree, or, you know,
I think
Tom Cruise imitations.
I don't have a Tom Cruise imitation yet, but I'm working on it and I'll come back soon with one. Hopefully that will impress everyone. But it kind of makes me sad that, you know, today I don't think anyone in his position would feel comfortable making any type of political statement. We're in this like world of both fear of being canceled and so quick to like cancel someone that really makes the conversation like watered down and bland. And I really think it's important for people who have a platform to be able to like try to talk about things, also to make mistakes and learn from it. I wish people could felt like they could say more. And then on top of it, you mentioned, you know, of course there's this whole Scientology element to Tom's life, but also like how much of a bubble is he living in? How engaged is he politically, if at all, these days? I don't know. I wonder if he like kind of, I think we've talked about celebrities living in bubbles. So I wonder if he's in the bubble, but maybe he'll come out of it and talk to
us. Oh, he's in a bubble. I guarantee you he is in a bubble and one of the weirdest, most insulated bubbles in the world. But I don't think he's in the same bubble as everyone else. He's really in his own bubble. But I agree with you. Some filmmakers, we're going to talk about one later on the same podcast and his quotes, some filmmakers are still comfortable with getting political. We certainly did on the last episode of this podcast, but yeah. Like some people really don't mind. But I think that there's just this ocean between, like, that's because many, many, many avenues towards audiences has opened up room to be political and reach people. Whereas Cruise is trying to hit the four quadrants. And now that means not being political. And I think that's the tragedy you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's also like a whole lot of interesting things to unpack with Top Gun Maverick, like both as filmmakers. Like, you know, I don't know what I read as in terms of where people assume I like movies, because like I love the Fast and the Furious franchise and I talk about it a lot. But then people frequently treat me as if I'm only into obscure art movies. Maybe that's the beard. I don't know. But like, you know, even if you're mostly into obscure art movies as an adult, like I started with Top Gun as a child, like at six, like that was the movie that was the gateway drug to cinema for me, as much as like, you know, I didn't watch my first art movie until I watched like Down by Law on the Sundance Channel when I was in eighth grade. So I would have been 12 and I was like, what is this? What is this? This is not like anything else. And so, you know, my formative cinema experiences were things like Top Gun. I mean, I'll fully admit, like, I was really sad when Tony Scott killed himself. Like, I had an emotional reaction to it, which I did not understand at the time how much I was emotionally invested in Tony Scott. And actually, the ending of my indie feature is a shot-for-shot homage to a scene in Top Gun that no one has ever commented on, because it's a little indie feature about relationships and Alzheimer's in West Virginia. But Tony Scott killed himself while we were shooting. And I wanted to sneak that in there because of how, like, wow, I hadn't really thought about how much Top Gun had an impact on me. So, like, thinking about Maverick, like, also is interesting.
Please
to think
tell
about
me
it
the homage is a volleyball scene.
No, no, it's not. Man.
You can be my wingman anytime.
I mean, I just say that all the time to everybody. Yeah. I've like, turned that out. But, oh man, I'm going to forget the name, but a really famous film professor at Pitt died. And there are all these wonderful honorariums on Twitter this week. And one of them had a quote of his that was like, I'm just a slut for movies. And, you know, and it was in reference to some student asking about like, wait a minute, you saw what? And he was like, I'm a slut for movies. I like them all. Like, bring them on. Like, I don't have a favorite movie. I just like cinema. And I feel like that a lot of the time. And so, yeah, Top Gun Maverick, I felt like was really interesting to think about in terms of this quote, in terms of like, well, what are the things that make it worthwhile? Like, what are the reasons you make a sequel other than pure money? Because obviously the reason Paramount made this is to make money, and no judgment. You know, I know people who work for Paramount. Paramount needs to keep their rent paid too. I'm not judging making money as a motivation for people, but it is really interesting, especially in a post. If you guys haven't seen T2's Trainspotting, it's really worth seeing, because it's, you know, the original Trainspotting is about heroin as a drug. And T2's Trainspotting is about nostalgia as a drug. And it's like, of every possible sequel there was to Trainspotting, it was the one that best captured the zeitgeist for me. And I felt like Top Gun Maverick was sort of interestingly at another end of the perspective where it very much kept itself unmediated. Like, it's about regret, and it's about the past haunting us and affecting our decisions, and it's about PTSD, and it's about all these nuanced things that aren't what we expect from a sequel. Like, it's about the way in which the past has shaped us, which is a whole lot more nuanced than we get from a Superman 2. And, like, so in a lot of ways, it tries to beautifully reckon with that. But these are characters who are not addicted to nostalgia as a drug. These are not, like, social media addicts. But they're people who are still affected palpably by the past and are desperately trying to outrun the effects of that past in a way that I think is, like, as storytellers, it's interesting to think about. I mean, another thing, this isn't what we initially kicked off with, but if, you know, if anybody is Olivier Assayas fans, I always loved his 90s film, Irma Vep, and now he's turned it into an HBO show, and I've been watching it, and it's really great. Also, Small HD is getting, like, the world's biggest product placement there. Irma Vep is about a filmmaker, and he's carrying around the Small HD monitor, and it's getting all these close-ups. And I desperately want to know, Small HD, if you listen to the podcast, please tell me if you paid for that product placement or if you just got it for free. Because, wow, it is, like, prominent. It is, like, good for you guys if you just lucked into that. But it's great because it's also reckoning with, like, you know, why do we keep telling stories? What is it about it that draws back to the same stories? And Irma Vep is a remake of a series of films from the 1920s when films were series before they were commonly features. And it's really trying to grapple with, like, well, there was this brief period of, like, the mid-20s till the 2010s when the feature was the thing, but now the serial's the thing again, which it was once before. I don't know. There's a lot here. Also, can I just say about Top Gun, the ending was the appropriate length. My biggest criticism of modern features is you go into these action movies and they've got these, like, 45 fucking minute climaxes, and it's goddamn motherfucking exhausting. And it's like Top Gun's climax is like 17 minutes. And you're like, oh, this is, like, the appropriate length for this final battle. And then you have the right number of twists, and then it's done. And you're like, oh, thank God. I could not have handled 45 minutes of, like, and then another twist, and then another twist, and then the mountain is alive. And I would have been like, ugh.
Yeah, you get to a point where it's just like you're watching light flash across the screen, and you're just like, what, why are we here again?
Yeah, why?
But I mean,
Nolan is to blame for that, but I'll hold on that thought.
Oh, who do you blame for the exceptionally long climax? I blame Michael Bay, who I think is a skilled filmmaker, but really enjoys the third act more than I think is rational.
I feel like Christopher Nolan, though, elevated that twisting the third act over and over, and espousing the thesis of the film to an art form where everybody was like, oh yeah, that's, yeah.
Going, like, hard, well, at the Nolan.
To me, yeah, Nolan's
the drama.
Nolan's notorious for having, like, the final acts of his movies be, like, kind of the worst part, I feel like. Like, towards the middle is usually, like, when stuff's really good, and then I'm always kind of like, man, this could have ended, like, three or four other times. And that has been, like, the Batman for me was like, God, how many times is this movie going to end? Totally. And then it ends on the worst possible one, where they're just like a long sequence of him and Catwoman, I guess, no spoilers, riding away on motorcycles. And it's just like, and they're just like, see ya. Okay, bye. And I'm like, there was, like, four other way cooler endings than that. But yeah, on the Tom Cruise thing, I felt really kind of silly when I started hearing about a lot of the kind of backlashy stuff about it being sort of like a right wingish type, like, Navy movie. Because when I saw it, I was on that amusement park ride. Like, I guess I just didn't really, like, think about it in that depth. And I mean, I grew up on the first Top Gun, much like Charles and many other people. And, like, it was like, it's cool. It's cool for a little kid to see, like, jets and people flying in jets, and, like, for a long time I wanted to fly jets, and then, you know, someone put a camera in my hands. But I think, you know, for me, like, I just went through this whole process of watching a lot of early Tom Cruise, and early Tom Cruise was badass. Like, he's always kind of, you know, I like his more recent stuff or whatever. Like, I'm a big fan of the Mission Impossible franchise. Like, I really enjoy pretty much every single one of those. But like Risky Business is like legit a really cool movie. And like, I mean, it's just like, it's kind of funny to watch, like, through his filmography, you can kind of watch like him slowly become Tom Cruise. And in that early phase of him, I just feel like I really like that version of Tom Cruise a lot more than like where we're at now. But like now, yeah, now it's like he's like a, I mean, someone could like literally just be like, hey, he's actually a like a cyborg, and we replaced him with a cyborg like 10 years ago and none of y'all noticed. And he's just printing money for us. That's all. And the real Tom Cruise is like hanging out on an island somewhere. Like, I wouldn't be that surprised if someone told me
Come on. If they turned him into a cyborg, then they've got him in a basement hooked up to tubes, right? He doesn't get to live on an island.
Preserving the genetics.
The truth story. Be careful. People would believe this. Like, if we made a video with like crappy effects, yeah, like we could totally convince a big person.
That time he jumped on a couch was like a malfunction.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I'm Cruz Truthers.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I do have to give the real Tom Cruise some credit for waiting to tell the story of Top Gun Maverick till they figured out what the story is and a story worth telling. I think we may have touched on this a couple weeks ago on the podcast, but at least there's like a story worth telling that also has roots in the original story. Meanwhile, I watched Jurassic World last night and I was like, why? What is telling the story? Lots of and talk about a whole film that was just built on nostalgia moments, but not just Jurassic Park nostalgia-ish moments, but there was like weird Star Wars and Indiana Jones references, and I was like, why?
Versus, they have absolutely destroyed every last fiber of that franchise.
I know.
Except for little kids. My daughter loves, there's like a animated show about it that my daughter, like, you know,
kids
she's
like dinosaurs. My kids are like asking all, they're curious about it now because it's like around and in the ether.
Well, and they did, they have Blue, and Blue is like the nice raptor, and now Blue has a baby, and you know, my daughter wants the baby and she wants the Blue. You know, they franchised it. They made it merchandise. But
totally,
yeah,
against the original story, though, in a way.
Right.
There was this one scene, and this is not a spoiler, but where Chris Pratt's character and Sam Neill's character are reunited. And of course, Sam Neill plays Dr. Grant in the original. He's great. He's like, these are not, you can't contain dinosaurs. And then they're sitting after like a big set piece of action and dinosaurs almost eating them. And Sam Neill's like, you're the guy who trains raptors. And Chris Pratt's like, yes. And then Sam Neill says, cool, or something like that. But I really wanted him to just say, like, that's so stupid.
Yeah.
And I was then like, yes, thank you.
Yeah. Far afield from the original book, which was about how ridiculously bad this would go, they become trainers of raptors. I just want to throw out there on like the Tom Cruise and smart and the way that this franchise changed and your point about Top Gun Maverick, you guys saying like original Top Gun, like really good movie, Tony Scott, great filmmaker, and occupies a special place in the pantheon and in nostalgia. And like, and I think that the truth is the second movie, they approached it the same way. And in speaking with the editor on it, it's like Tom Cruise is just exacting. Like, he's the final word on all things Top Gun Maverick. And it has to be. And they reshoot and reshoot. And there's tons of footage. And it's a year plus process. And it's truly like everything has to be the best possible version of what they can do. And they have the ability to do that, which is so rare that you can afford to do to approach it that way. But even many times when people can, they don't. So it's a testament to that. Mm-hmm. I'll also just throw out there that, like, Tom Cruise was a legitimately, like, crazy person. And everything about Scientology is pretty bad. And the stuff that's going on there is pretty bad. And there's no doubt about it. Like, it's not about, like, I'll be the one to say it. Like, it's not just about what faiths people practice. That's all well and good and none of my business. It's the institution of it has, like, really ruins people's lives. And he's the benefactor of that. So that just I don't want to talk Tom Cruise without putting that out there. But he is incredible at what he does. Those things.
I do want to point out that Top Gun Maverick does attempt to reckon with some of the changes in the world. And, like, you know, I'm specifically wary of Copaganda. Like, I'm really bummed that my daughter isn't a Paw Patrol now, because it seems very much like Copaganda to me. And
I love that. I love that take. I haven't thought of that.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Like, once you see it, you're like, oh my God, this is totally, that's not how cops act, Chase. Like, that is like not how cops act.
Your kid's like, I want to be a cop, but I also want to be a dog.
A doggy.
Yeah. It's associate. Yeah. Chase is anyway. But, and you know, so I have some issues with, like, the original Top Gun and, like, promoting and, like, you know, all of that. But, like, there is some interesting stuff of, like, growth in Top Gun Maverick. Like, for instance, age appropriate love interest for Maverick. Like, literally, if that movie had been made 10 years earlier, Maverick would have been dating a 30-year-old.
Yeah.
And Maverick was dating a 51-year-old, which is 9 years younger than Tom Cruise. But that's, like, significantly better than if that movie was made 10 years earlier. And we know that because we have the movies Tom Cruise was making 10 years earlier for reference, and he was dating 28 and 32-year-olds. And it was like the culture changed and was like, actually, guys, we've decided that that's gross and we no longer want to consume it as a culture. And, like, it just, you know, it helps when you cast Jennifer Connelly. Like, she's wonderful. But, like, it was like, oh, okay, age-appropriate love interests. Like, nice, love this. And, like, you know, appropriate love scene between mature couple. Like, I was like, okay, this is not what I was expecting out of a Top Gun sequel. And yeah, there's interesting stuff in Top Gun Maverick. Moving on to whether or not there will be interesting stuff in another sequel that's taken a long time, but we don't know if it will evolve with the times or not. James Cameron is out on record saying, stop bitching about my movie being 3 hours. I know you guys all binge watch 12-hour TV shows. Shut your ugly faces. That's a direct quote from his Twitter.
Shut your ugly faces?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think he said that part. But he didn't spare much. And he goes on and talks about his kids. Like, it's really turns into an old man rant of, like, my kids are watching these things for 8 hours and, like, to the bathroom.
Has he been hanging out with Eastwood? Is that what's going on?
I mean, before we talk about anything else, we have to talk about the fact that this is all deliberate trolling to get attention. This is the same reason Scorsese says shit about Marvel movies when he hasn't. Like, have we heard anything about Scorsese saying shit about Marvel in the last 2 years? No, because he doesn't have a movie in the movie theaters. So this is all, I have a movie coming out and I want a press cycle. That's all this is. Scorsese also does it. Cameron does it.
And James Cameron made the original long movie, Titanic, which was on two VHSs because I had them and I was only allowed to watch the first VHS.
Oh, whoa. Is the second one sexier or something?
No, that's when
the infamous paint me like one of your French girls.
No, the weird thing is that's in the first VHS.
It's really?
The stinking that happens. I mean, it's essentially, in a way, two movies. One is a happy ending if you just stop at the end of VHS.
Oh, so your parents were cool with the sex stuff. They just didn't want you to watch a bunch of people die?
Yes.
They didn't want you to see the part where someone's body hits the propeller and they flop around like a rag doll. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah,
actually, I respect your parents on this one. Good call, Gigi's parents.
I'll let them know. But, you know, that's a 2.5 hour long movie. And now that
Gone with the Wind might have been The original long movie.
Fair.
No. But no, Godfather. If we're talking about that, that is a different animal. Because let's talk about the most important thing here, which is human biology. You better not be making a movie that breaks a 3-hour barrier without an intermission. and a potty break. Because
yes. Like, they had those that back is, then. Yeah.
But theaters don't want to do that anymore because they view it as wasted time. And theaters don't even want to do a 3-hour movie anymore because they get more you know, you pay the same for a 3-hour movie and a 2-hour movie. But theaters can book 2 3-hour screenings a night, like a 6:30 and a 9:30 or a 7 and a 10. And the 10 won't sell as well. But a 2-hour movie or an hour and a half, they can do a 6:30 and an 8 and a 9:30. And then maybe for the real latecomers, like an 11. Right. And so theaters are really reluctant to do the 3-hour.
I do have to make a plug for an app called RunPee, where you sync up the app with your.
I love the idea. Yeah, I love this.
And it tells you, it like buzzes. Yeah, exactly. You're like, this is the app I didn't know that I absolutely needed. It buzzes when it's like a really lull in the story and you can use the restroom, and then it'll tell you what happens and you can come in. So like, you know that when like, you sync it up when the title cards are coming, and then it's like, and then Maverick will go on a walk on a beach. You can pee now.
I like when you, the old thing of people come back and be like, what I miss? Be like, nothing, who cares? Like, just watch the movie. You'll figure it out. Like, it's, you know, like, don't bother me. Why are we talking about this? Funny story about going to pee. I took my kids to see Lightyear a few weeks ago, and I had to go to the bathroom and walked out, and I missed the big moment being the reason that the movie is like that. They put warnings and signs because there's like a same sex kiss. And I came back and I was like, oh, I missed it. I should like post like I walked out during the, you know, whatever. The
troll. Oh, I thought you missed the big moment where he turned into light.
No, where he turned into the toy on Andy's shelf. No, we're going to leave the memes of that movie aside for now. I want to bring up, though, before we go too far afield from James Cameron and his quotes, that he added another a doozy here. He said, the trolls will have it that nobody gives a shit and they can't remember the characters' names or one damn thing that happens in the movies, Cameron said of the backlash to the original film. Then they see the movie again and go, oh, okay, excuse me, let me shut the fuck up right now. So I'm not worried about that. So what he's talking about there is something we've talked about before, which is that people are like, can you remember, there's this meme, it's like, can you remember anyone's name in Avatar? Like, the plot was basic and all these things. I think we did an episode that we even called it like this James Cameron's Waterloo. Because we were like, is this kind of like, are there cracks in the facade? Because the guy's pretty much made a good movie every time out, objectively speaking. Like, it's like hard to find flaw. And yet, it does feel like, man, this is going to be over 3 hours. And like the first Avatar started to feel like things were getting a little dicey there. And yeah, but further in the article, he also talks about how he's already finished 3. He can't wait to make 4. He might have another director do 4 and 5, but probably not. So it's a very like, Charles is 100% right. Like, this is his PR tour and he's riling people up. But two things. One, he's feeding the trolls for sure. And I say that as somebody who can be a troll. Like, if you are acknowledging the exact complaints of the internet community, you are emboldening them to continue to make all the complaints in the world, because all they want is to be heard. They just want to know that like James Cameron knows what they said about his movie. So it's kind of like when I read it, I was like, no, James, don't do it. Like, don't tell them you're listening, because now who knows what this like unleashes in the, you know, we have a problem with fans and trolls like getting really nasty and ugly. There's a kind of trolling that I think is funny and a kind that I think is awful. You know, I think in some way he's emboldening them. But on the other hand, I just bring up that, you know, yeah, it's like he's really all in on this thing. And it feels
there's intense. Like 4 of them on the way, right? Like he's making a ton of these.
Yes. Third one's in the can, and there's a 4 and 5 that he's planning that he says he will likely also direct. That's just a lot in this day and age of movies and theatrical release, and like he's going hard.
Yeah, and if they're all 3 hour, I mean, you know, you're like competing with Lord of the Rings at that point, like the extended editions, like that's a lot of content. I'm curious. I would like to, what is y'all's ideal? Like what's the longest a movie can be before you kind of start going, maybe I don't want to watch that tonight. Like, what's sort of, because for me, I kind of like
12 minutes.
I don't know.
So, one episode of Paw Patrol.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, when he says, you know, y'all, you binge watch, you know, 12 hours of TV or whatever, like, the thing is for me, like, I don't do that really. I don't like to binge watch TV shows. Like, I'll watch like an episode and then try to put on a movie or something. Like, but for me on a, you know, on a Wednesday night, if I'm like, oh, I see this movie that my friends keep telling me I need to watch and now it's streaming, but it's 2 hours and 50 minutes. I'm like, man, do I really want to be like this tired tomorrow? Like, I don't know. For me, if it's a theatrical experience, which Avatar, the first Avatar, I only saw it in theaters. I was skipping my college classes, and for whatever reason, I went to it like four times in 3D, and I didn't even really like it that much. I think I just was more interested in the skipping class aspect of it. But I, you know, that movie was definitely way cooler in theaters, and I could definitely, I'm way more game to sit for 3 hours. I do also agree on the necessity of a, you know, intermission of some sort. But yeah, I don't know. Like, the thing about Avatar now is, it's just like watching the first Avatar. Like, I remember one time I tried to watch it on like TBS on a Sunday, and it was like 2 p.m. and I was like kind of falling in and out of a nap. And it was just like, this movie doesn't work in this format at all. And yeah. So, you know, obviously, you know, he's going to have to really make sure people go to the theater. And if they don't, I don't really know if, you know, I don't know. It's cool that it's like, it's a movie about like, you know, preserving nature and respecting nature. And I've heard him, you know, talk a lot about that kind of stuff. And I, you know, I like that aspect of the franchise. But dang, I really don't feel like I need 5 of those things, yeah. Personally.
I definitely am with you in terms of the scrolling through, choosing a movie. And when I see it's like 2.5 hours, I'm like, no, thank you. There's actually a 90-minute movie section in Netflix that I purposely navigated to the other night because I was like, it's too late. Like, I don't want to sit here and unless it's totally warranted. And I think, Todd, you mentioned The Godfather, where it's like, that's one where it's like, we turn off the lights, we turn off the cell phones, we bring out the popcorn, and we just sit there and watch a damn good movie.
Yeah, it's an event. You're making an event out of it.
Exactly. But rarely is anything that good that consistently for over 2 hours, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, any 3-hour movie, I would say at least 60 to 70% of them, they could have cut a lot of it out and it would have been better. Like, I just really feel that way. Ultimately, there's just nothing better to me than like a 90-minute movie that's just from start to finish, the pacing's right, the story's locked down. It just feels like there wasn't a wasted moment. Like, that's my favorite kind of movie, is like just something that you throw it on and for 90 minutes, you get a complete truncated story that just feels right. And George, Charles, yeah. what's y'all's take on?
Well, there was a great, you know, what's his face, the handsome guy that everyone wants to date from Saturday Night Live. One of his last SNL skits was about, give me those short Netflix movies, and it was just a rap about like looking for short movies on Netflix, and then all of his friends making fun of him because all of his, you know, he did King of Staten Island, which is like Pete 7 hours long or something. Pete Davidson, yeah, tall with baggy eyes, and you know, there is something. I mean, my thing. Is the thing people don't tend to appreciate about a really well-crafted 90-minute to 2-hour movie is people are like, and I think it's a fair criticism to be like, every time I see a 3-hour movie, I feel like it could have been cut down. But the bigger problem is that cutting down should have happened before you started shooting. And it's these sprawling scripts. And so you're like, and I'll watch the movie and I'll be like, yeah, there's actually nothing you can cut because you backed yourself into a corner where you need all of this setup to explain why this happens. But all of that setup was boring as shit. So I'm stuck with all this boring ass setup to explain why this thing happens. And you needed to compress that in the script stage to get that to one scene of setup that does the job. But you spread it over 4 scenes and you're stuck with it all now. And that's the thing, is that the hard step is like getting it there before post. I'm vicious. My wife doesn't understand this, but like I turn movies off regularly about 20. I'll give movies like a first act, like 20, 25 minutes in. And then I turn them off because I'm like, you don't even deserve 90 minutes. If I'm 20 minutes in and there's not a character or a setup or a situation that's like intriguing or fresh or like feels real or something to me, if you're not in control of your tone, if you haven't done one thing that surprised me, I'm like, I don't feel like you deserve the rest of the time. I'd rather like start a different movie.
I'm completely again, the same way. And I'm even more so that way with shows because like there's so, my biggest pet peeve is like, yeah, season one is okay, but in season two kind of sucks too. But if you can get to season three, it's the greatest show of all time. And I'm like, I will never watch that in a million years. I do not have that kind of time in my life. Yeah, I do not care.
There are two exceptions to that. One is Parks and Rec, where the first season was legitimately kind of bad, but I didn't watch it. And then someone was like, oh no, they retooled, they got a new writer's room, and just start with season two. Don't even bother with season one. And I don't know that I've ever gone back and watched season one, but starting from season two, Parks and Rec kind of rocked.
I didn't mind season one. It's not, but a comedy show is a whole different animal. Like I'm talking about like when you're like, I tried to get through The Wire and obviously, you know, everyone loves The Wire. It's a very beloved show, but there was like, I can't remember which season it was.
It's two.
Yeah.
I love two so much.
I do for me it was
I am alone.
Which season was it with like the shipping containers and all that?
Two.
Okay. So I got
it's
to
me.
That.
I am the fan club. Like, you have met the entire fan club. I'm president, I'm treasurer, it's me.
I actually like two. But what I think is my answer to this question is that is twofold. And I think it's a really good one, especially for people who are sort of thinking about like how they make their stories. And like these days, I really think you have to go as economic and short as possible because you're not James Cameron. Unfortunately, you may become him. But my personal thing is like I will complain about things being long, but if they're good, I don't have any problem with it. If they're good to me. You know, and no one can hit that sweet spot because nobody knows, and nor should they try because I'm a strange person with strange taste. But what I'm saying is just from my own perspective, like if it works for me, I don't mind. Like the time can go very fast. Like, and I can enjoy and sometimes think like, I kind of wish there was more, you know, like ups and downs, slow periods, sure. But the problem is that when I watched The Wire, while there was starting to be a lot to compete for my time, there was nowhere near as much as there is now. I do not know if I could make it now. Just because I went slow through that show and it's such a thoughtful, careful, intentional, like beautiful piece, but it's not, whenever people say this stuff, like you can't do such and such for today. And that's become like a meme unto itself, but it's really like pacing is so different. There's so many demands on our time. Even texting wasn't as pervasive then when I was watching it as it was now. Like you can't get a second. Like, and I think that that's why, like if you're setting out and looking at the landscape and thinking about what to do, you really should aim for that 90 to 110 and make it like taut as hell because people have so many things to look at or think about or be distracted by. And episode to episode, I've fallen off on shows. The idea of someone saying to me a show, like it takes a while to get into it now, it's like, it doesn't even matter. Like, I'm not going to even bother. Like if it has to be so, like I've fallen off on shows I liked because I was like, I don't feel like I have time to keep up anymore. Like the first few seasons were great. I'm done. You know, so I think it's a tough environment. And if you're James Cameron, like, yeah, go for it. Like make 10 4-hour long movies and tell us all to fuck off if we don't like it. that's what you're allowed to do, I guess. But
James Cameron's like, you'll watch it.
He's probably right. And like, it's like when Quentin Tarantino made even Hateful Eight, like I was so excited. Like I was like, I don't mind that I'm sitting down for all this time. Like give it to me in like the full format projected on film. I'll go out for intermission. I love it. Like, but yeah, that is such a tough sell. Charles talked about it.
Everyone who has seen that movie too. Okay, that's the one. I haven't seen Hateful Eight, which is insane to me. And really kind of a good signpost to like this whole conversation for me. Like, I haven't seen it. And that's because everyone I've talked to about it like kind of goes like, ugh, yeah, it's kind of a slog, but it's pretty good. And I'm just like, okay.
Yikes. That's the worst thing you can say.
I watched it, and I watched its extended version on Netflix, which is like 6 hours long.
Oh my God.
It's really good. I really like it.
Okay.
I like Westerns.
I'll check it. No, I like Westerns too. I'll check it out. I need to check it out. I've been saying that since it came out though.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's Kurt Russell and Samuel L. Jackson in a Western snowed in a cabin. And like, you've got, I mean, it's great.
The music is a reason alone.
Yeah. They got the crew gift was a snow globe, which is like, like it's a custom made snow globe. Anyway, but like for me, like I love a 90-minute movie. I will love a 2.5-hour movie that doesn't have every moment land if your vibe is good enough. But vibe and charisma are really hard to do on a low budget. So I'm trying to think offhand of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is like 2.5 hours. And I love it. And it could have been 30 minutes longer because you've got Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt.
Oh, I would have sat there for 6 hours.
Oh my God, easily.
Driving around LA in the 70s.
Oh my God.
Like, but what you have is a director who has his reps in and has a budget and has actors who can act.
Totally.
And I kind of want to tie this back into like indie emerging filmmakers who are making shorts. I think if you can really embrace that less is more, and you can being economical about it, and your storytelling will make your project usually so much better. Like, be in that early scripting stage. Like, I'd rather have a 3-minute amazing short than like another 15 to 20 minute short film that is like meandering and I'm like, why am I here? I don't get the vibe. I'm so bored. When does this end? You know, like, leave me wanting more. And I'm saying this because I had to watch a bunch of shorts recently where I'm like, Is this a rough cut this is the short. Got it.
This is such a good point because we were talking about endings before and I mentioned Christopher Nolan and you mentioned Michael Bay, Charles, and like, Gigi, you're bringing it back in such a meaningful way because there's the old thing, right? Like, get in late, get out early. And that's just never a bad idea. And if you get to the point where you have made so many movies and you have such a devoted audience and you have major movie stars, et cetera, you can linger forever. You can take your time and screw around and it doesn't matter. But we should not look at those movies and those movies' pacing as the model, because that's what I kind of hate sometimes with the screenwriting books and how they'll like break down these beloved, like, you know, they'll put Godfather in and they'll like talk about how it's perfect. And it's like, maybe. But sometimes you have the power to do things that like, it's, you know what I mean? Like, you can reverse engineer it sometimes to look like it's all like plotted exactly right. But I think the reality is you have to focus way more at the front end on, am I keeping people engaged all the time?
Yeah. Well, and even just that moment of someone deciding to watch your thing. Like, if like my best friend said, Hey, I have a 25-minute short film, can you watch it? It would take me a while to get through it. I'd probably have to watch, you know, five, 10-minute chunks, unless it was really, really, really good. And yeah, I mean, I think it's just, again, everything kind of competing for our time and attention and all that sort of stuff. It's just like, you know, these are the days of like, you can't really have a wasted moment in your thing. And on that note, I was just curious. So Jurassic World Dominion, 146-minute runtime, for shame, that did not need to be that long. That is.
Have you also seen it?
I have not, but I just know. When I saw the trailer,
no, I agree
when
I
saw
you.
Chris
I also
Pratt
agree
sticking
with you.
His arm out, and I was just like, no, hell no. I'm not watching 146 minutes
stay,
of that.
Stay, dinosaur, stay.
I'm Chris Pratt, and you're going to stay. You know, I just had to bring that up, that Jurassic World Dominion is over 2.5 hours long.
That is that's a lot. All right. So moving on, let's talk about some positivity of like building community with your filmmaking peers through backyard cinema.
Yeah.
Gigi.
Oh, I'll kick this off. So I, you know, moved to LA at the top of the pandemic and started making sketches and shorts and stuff. And my only experience screening anything was either releasing it online or going to a film festival, which, you know, you make something and then it's like a year and a half later, you screen it in maybe. But a friend of mine who I weirdly met at a film festival told me about this backyard screening monthly thing. And ever since then, I've started to like hear little bits and pieces about these other backyard screenings. So the first one that I went to, I actually submitted short of mine to screen. I didn't tell anyone except for a friend and that I went with, the one who had told me about it. And I just like went to test out to see if this short was going to work in front of an audience. And it was at this place called Show and Tell. These two comedy dudes, a guy named Seth Ward and a guy named Kyle Heff, they put it on, and they've been putting it on for 9 years now. And the whole MO behind it is to like get people creating things and sharing things and supporting each other. And I was like, this is so lovely. Of course, when I was screening my short, I stood in the back and like just wanted to see if the audience would laugh at all, because I was determining whether I should even submit it to festivals or just release it online and bury it, you know, as one does. And it was just really refreshing to, one, be with an audience, especially after the pandemic, but two, see a community of filmmakers and sketch people and people shooting with whatever they can to make something and try something. And sometimes they were trying, like testing things out, and it was kind of more in a rough cut phase. Other times it was like, these are a bunch of little sketches that I put together back to back to back to back. And I was like, man, this is awesome. And I think now more than ever, we need to be like encouraging people to make things and come together and celebrate it's hard to make anything. So I just loved it and wanted to give it a little shout out. And I don't know if you guys have had any of this sort of underground screening experience, but yeah.
That sounds so cool.
Makes me like, it
was so fun. So you said you found it through a friend?
Yeah, a friend of mine. All the ones that I've gone to have like very generic names, like, oh, Show and Tell or Sunday Fun Day. And I'm like, oh, these are just things. And then I'm realizing that they're actually like events that people put on regularly to like celebrate comedy or making things. And so, yeah, a friend mentioned it. I emailed the guys and they're like, yeah, we'll screen it. Yeah. So it's very word of mouth heavy. That's how they get the word out, I guess. And on Instagram.
But that's cool, because that means like the community there is like authentic. It's just people being like, hey, this thing's cool, come check it out. Which is, you know, instead of it just being like marketed or something a ton.
Yeah.
I need to do more kind of looking for that kind of stuff around here. It feels like there's not a lot, but I'm sure there is. Like, I'm sure there's stuff around me that I need to. Yeah. So,
I mean, the thing I always try and remember is if I'm looking for something and not finding it, that usually means I should just start it myself.
There you go.
Like, there's been a lot of times in my life where I'm like, I would like X to be happening and no one's doing it. And then I'm like, oh, I guess I'm supposed to now. And the other cool thing about this is, as I try and say to my students all the time, like, gatekeepers never open a door to let you in. Gatekeepers open a door because you're doing something cool outside and they want to come see what it is.
Word.
And it's like, if you want to get into anywhere, unless you're like incredibly handsome and already wealthy and very good looking, like then you might be able to just get in. But like for the most part, like you just have to be doing cool shit somehow. Like somehow you just have to be doing cool shit all the time. And so like, yeah, if you get a screening thing going with your friends very quickly, it's amazing how much when you start something small, people just, I remember when I was first starting my production company with my partner, and like it was two of us. And then like within a week, like it was four of us. And then like three other friends were like, hey, we hear you doing a thing. Can we just start like working out of your office? Cause we like feel like we'd be more productive if we had somewhere to go every day. And then we blinked and it was like 20 regular people around all the time just cause we were doing a thing. And I feel like my friends who've done screening series like this, it's been the same way of like, they were like, well, we don't know who's going to come. And like the first time it was seven. And then like, you know, a year later, it was like 40 people in the backyard all the time. And like those kind of low level network events are like vital to how you grow as an artist, because one of the biggest problems in film is, you know,
it's super lonely. It's funny,
well, it's insanely lonely and it can take years to get anything made.
Or am I just like, lonely out here?
No, it's just crazy. Well, Joseph Kaczynski is such a crazy story of like, he became a big studio director. He went to architecture school. And then his bio on IMDb is like, he left architecture school. He was an adjunct in architecture at MIT. And then he started doing commercials, and then he got Tron Legacy. And that's the bio. And I'm like, what happened in those 10 years that got him Tron Legacy? Like, what? What was that 10-year journey between like leaving architecture school and getting a major studio picture? Because that's a mystery to me.
Yeah. Or Colin Trevorrow, who's like, he made a mediocre indie film and then...
An actively bad indie film. Like, and a then, terrible...
And then started immediately ruining beloved franchises.
Well, I mean, no, his family is childhood friends with Kathleen Kennedy. Like, he grew up in Kathleen Kennedy's house. Oh,
I didn't know that. I've always had a sneaking suspicion that he might...
Well, that explains it.
Oh, yeah, because safety, not guaranteed. Safety not guaranteed. You should never be allowed to work again after that. That movie was awful. The performance...
I turned
like,
it off.
No. Oh, I had to finish never it because I saw it in the theater. And it, like, the acting is... Like, the acting by people who are normally good is atrocious, which means the director didn't know how to shape it. And, like, there's a whole scene with a crane where I'm like, oh, you had a crane for a day and didn't know what to do with it. So you just put it in every shot for no reason. Like, it's like, that movie is gibberishly bad. It's oh, God. And then, apparently, that was good enough to get him. Yeah, no. Like, there are so many better indie movies that get made every year.
Can I tell you something embarrassing?
Yes.
He went to my high school. And so I...
Ooh.
Piedmont High School, go Highlanders. I DM'd him and asked him to go get coffee, but he never got back to me.
That's not embarrassing. Did the right thing. You should be proud.
You did the right thing.
Because
you got out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, those cold emails or DMs are often like people should send those, because for 100 that are just annoying and ignored, there might be one or two that help you learn something or move forward. So people should do that. That was smart of you.
Which reminds me, Tori Amos went to my high school, and I should probably not DM her because that's probably not useful, but it is a good reminder.
I just want to throw out there, because I've talked about it before, but I know Gigi's also familiar, that Channel 101 started essentially as like a backyard screening. And it was just these people getting together who were doing that exact thing. They were like, and it was like 2005 or 2004 or something. But like, so everything was different. There were stagecoaches instead of cars. But like there were just people gathering in like a Thai restaurant, screening stuff. The people who would go on and become like the Lonely Island and stuff were doing it. But like, they were just like, we shot a fun little thing. Let's watch it. Let's critique it. Let's have an assignment. And it slowly built into a community, and it slowly became formalized. And then really like built over time. But that spirit of just getting together, having a community of making things, creating a deadline, creating like a workflow, collaborating with the people you meet there, that's maybe one of the better things that comes out of a film school as well. So totally. It's like, if you can create it like somewhere else where you get those collaborative learning experiences, you don't get the same, but sometimes you do get instructors, because like when I came around into the world of Channel 101, there were like senior members who had been doing it long enough and who had sniffed real jobs and like had real pitches. And so like, if I went out to do something, I could ask those people I'd met and they could help me to some extent, and that sort of thing. And I saw it work for so many people, so many careers built out of getting into a community like that, working the edges of it towards the middle, getting better at what you do, and like making tons and tons and tons of content. Like, so those things are a real avenue, I think, to getting better at this.
I used to have sort of like an ego around being the organizer. And I think it's because I like had a different career where I was like put in a box of being adjacent to the creative and supporting creatives. And to your point, Charles, about like sometimes you want something and then you're like, oh, actually, I'm just going to have to do it myself. Recently, I felt really like good about putting on what I call the Paul McCartney hat, which is like the person who's like, come on, guys, let's do this. Let's make something. Because I watched the Beatles documentary and I was like, oh, he's just rallying people. And there, you know, not only do you have the opportunity, if you're producing something like this, to put your own work out there, but you're lifting up other people. And there's a lot of like cross pollination. Like when I screened at Show and Tell, this guy named Mark Sipka, who's a very funny actor who has the best mullet in the world, he reached out to me after and said my short was like one of his favorite things that he's ever seen there. And I was like, thanks, man. We got coffee. I was like, I want to cast you in something. I cast him in like a janky little sketch I made. And then I also cast him in like the final episode of my Channel 101 series. Found out he had amazing chemistry with this other comedian named Madison Lanacy. And now I know I need to shoot a short with these two because they're so great. But I would have never known this had I not like started to make things and just get those reps in and collaborate and find people that I jive with. So shout out to Mark Sipka too and your mullet. It's great.
All right. Should we wrap it up with tech news?
Yeah, I think so.
So we're going to do a follow-up tech news. So if you're like, I've already heard enough about the Lao and Nanomorphs, peace out. We'll see you next week. You know who we are. But secondly, if not, Todd and I are going to talk a little bit further about the Lao Nanomorphs because I had a lot of fun shooting them on this job. I shot them as B camera. A camera was an Alexa with Atlas Orions.
Nice. Okay.
And B camera was a DJI 4D with Lao Nanomorphs. And I was
I think one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it with you, because we talked a lot together about the Ronin 4D when it came out. And my biggest beef was the weight capacity for the lenses or whatever. And so I saw on your video that you were using it with the Ronin 4D. So I imagine that was pretty sick.
It was ridiculous. I kind of want to shoot a whole feature. I remember I was a gaffer on a feature in 2006 and we got light panels. And I remember bringing out light panels and I was like, I want to do a whole movie. We light the whole thing LED, which like now we do all the fucking time. But right. Like I remember that moment of like, holy shit, what? What are these? And they don't get hot and I can glue them to the ceiling. Oh my God. This was kind of that. Like I was like, oh my God, like I can do an anamorphic feature just on the 4D with these and be incredibly happy with the footage.
So now these are MFT, right? They don't have any.
No, they're native D-mount. You can get them MFT as well.
Okay.
But it was a native D-mount, which really tells me Lawa is like, we know where our bread's going to be buttered.
Interesting.
These are going to be pop. So D-mount is DJI's lens mount.
So they're going straight for, like, they knew exactly what was going on with that, with the 4D.
I wonder if they were going MFT and then it was easy enough for them to add a D-mount. Because it was last October, now it was announced. These came out in May. 6 months is probably enough time to add a D-mount to a lineup.
Right.
I'm thinking.
They have EF on the way, right? I think I remember reading that somewhere.
I don't think so. I think that's too shallow. I think they'll have E-mount because you can do Super 35 because they only cover Super 35.
Right.
So I think they have E on the way, but I don't think it'll be EF because these are really like flush lenses.
I love it. I love it. So there's been, you know, I'm obsessed with low budget anamorphics. It's like, it's kind of an obsession for me. I go through little seasons where I, you know, I'll go buy one of those, like an old adapter for projector lenses or whatever. And, you know, I'll try to work that way for a little while. And then I decide it's way too much trouble and I stop doing it. And then I start Googling, you know, what's the newest, like, and I keep waiting for a cheap anamorphic that doesn't look like ass. And there's a couple out there that are close-ish. There's like this one, I think it's like Great Joy that just popped on the market with funny name, but it's like, I think they have a, you know, at the very least, I know there's like one or two lenses out in their line, but even those are, you know, they're in the four-ish, five-ish grand range, I think. And you know, the flares are ridiculous. They're like super blue. All the SLR magic stuff is super blue. And I kind of just like, I just, you know, what's the Saray? They have those that are also very, very blue. And for me, with anamorphic, it's so much more personally about the field of view and the, you know, the bokeh and all that than it is really about the flares, because you can tape a piece of fishing line on the front of your lens and you get some flares. I'm not really that big of a deal. I'm not that precious about the flares, but it is a nice little aspect. So for me, when I saw these, the Lawas, the flare just looks really kind of almost exactly what you'd want. Similar to, I don't know which Atlas lenses you were using, but I got a chance to do a couple gigs on the silver editions of the Atlas lenses, which takes the flare from the original set and makes it kind of this like ambery, whitish color that I was super into. I love that look. I'm not like against the blue flare thing, but I feel like it can be a bit distracting and it can kind of limit you creatively in some scenarios. But from what I saw with these Lauas, it seemed like they were like the colors of the flares are kind of, and I know there's like a orange one and a blue one, right?
There's an orange one and a blue one. And then just this week they dropped a silver one.
Oh, hell yeah.
And the silver one is going to be a neutral flare. I was shooting blue flare. I'm old, so I'm very used to Anamorphics having blue flare. But I remember I was talking to Art Adams at Aerie when they were dropping the Signature Primes. And the Signature Primes deliberately went for really neutral colored flares, was their whole thing. Was they were like, we want our flares colorless because we feel like in HDR, colored flares are more distracting than they used to be in SDR. In SDR, you got a lens flare and it's got a little color, it's fine. But once you start cranking that brightness up in HDR, a lot of your flares tend to be high brightness. And then you add color to that and it gets really disorienting.
Yeah.
So as we move to more, so as you get to more HDR deliverables, we think people are going to want less color in their flares. So the Signature Primes, they were like, we worked really hard on colorless flares. And you're right, the Atlas, we were actually shooting non-silver Atlas. So there were some color in our flares and we quite liked it. And so it was nice. But even the blue Lauas were not that blue. They were like a little blue, but it wasn't like Panavision Super Speed Anamorphic from the 70s blue streaks. It was like, oh, it's a little touch of blue and a little touch of green that kind of worked for me. But honestly, if I were buying, I would probably buy the silvers.
Yeah. Because,
you know,
I think that's
HDR deliverable option.
And that's where like my perspective on the blue flare thing mostly lies. Like I think renting, if you're going to rent lenses, having per job the choice to go blue or not or whatever, totally fine. And like I love the look of classic blue flares, but it's just not always right. So if I'm going to buy something, I want something with more naturalistic colors in the flares. And so that's why these things popped up, and I was like, I don't have a Micro Four Thirds camera right now, so I would love it if they could eventually drop something for...
Well, I'm sure they'll do Fuji X.
Well, I do have that, so that would be nice.
They might even have Fuji X now.
Okay.
But they will do X, I'm sure, because Laowa usually covers X. But it's always going to be those flatter mounts. So it's going to be... Yeah, you're going to end up... they're probably not going to do EF, because the flange focal distance is so shallow from like the back of the lens body before the mount starts.
Right.
I don't think there's room for an EF in there.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in terms of actual, like, you know, being an owner of anamorphic lenses, I feel like that's kind of one of the better options out there right now. I mean, maybe if you can fork it out for the Atlas set, go ahead. But yeah, I think visual quality wise, it's the best option I've seen.
I mean, I was astounded at the visual quality for $1,500. I was like, $1,500 lenses shouldn't look this good when they're not anamorphic. And then when they are anamorphic, I'm like, okay, you guys are doing something crazy cool here. And like Laowa, I like Laowa. They make cool stuff, but their previous move was not, we look the nicest. Their previous move was, we're the most comfortable being weird.
For sure.
The two things you would have previously known Laowa for were their probe lens and their zero distortion wide angle lenses, both of which are like, we're a little out of the norm. We're really wide angle or we're probe. And so like image quality is not the most important. They both look nice. I've shot with both. I've intercut both with nicer lenses. Like they hold up. Neither of them are bad lenses, but they're not like, we're really nice looking. They're like, we're weird and we look good. Whereas these are like a real swing at like cutting above their weight for 1500. I mean, the choice really becomes they only open to a 2.8 and the 2.8 is legit, not their sweet spot. You really want to shoot at a 4. As opposed to the Atlas that opened at a 2 and they really start to look good between a 2 and a 2.8. So you get like a stop and a half extra light out of the Atlas. But like you're never going to fly those Atlas on a stabilizer. Like they're big, heavy anamorphic lenses. So for action or sports, or like, you know, I do a lot of bike work. I do narrative bike work. Like that's my thing right now, is like telling stories about people living lives on bikes. I'm not like a sports action guy. I'm like a bike lifestyle guy. And like these are great for that in a way that no other anamorphic is.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're not going to find anything close, I don't think.
Yeah.
Especially that you could stick on a Ronin 4D. And they have, it's a 1.5 squeeze, right? Is it constant through the whole range? Like, because I know that some of the cheaper ones, it like changes, which is weird.
Like, it's marked as changing? Like, they tell you it changes, or you have just experienced it changing?
No, it's like a factor of the lens itself. Like, there's a, I think that one that I was talking about before, I think it's Great Joy is the name of the company that makes it, but it's like a 1.5 to 1.3x. So it changes.
I gotta read about this lens.
As you close the iris, it changes.
As you change the iris, or as the focus distance?
Focus.
Changes?
My bad. Focus. Yeah. Focus. It's focus. So yeah. if you're like focused up close, you have less anamorphic squeeze than like far away or whatever. Which is
Great Joy Optical.
Is that it? Did you find it? I think that's
I'm looking at it.
But yeah, that was like, I mean, for me, that's just kind of like, okay, well, I'll just shoot spherical and never have fun lenses if that's what I got to deal with. Cause I don't even really know. I'm sure that like kind of looks like breathing in terms of the, when you're pulling focus, I'm sure that's what that looks like. So yeah. And I noticed that these also have like the Lauas have a really close minimum focus, don't they? Like for anamorphic.
For anamorphic, I was entirely satisfied with the minimum focus. Okay. I was like, oh, yeah, okay. What I really desperately want, so right now the only things they have out are a 27, a 35, and a 50. I really want a 75.
Yeah.
Like,
that's when anamorphic really sings.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
When you're like, it's dusk, and you got like a skyline, and you're on a 75, and like that on the 4D moving, like, yeah. You know, we'll get there. I mean, honestly, it's making me like, I'm debating, I'm probably going to get a 4D, and I'm debating going up to the 8K 4D so I can get 6K resolution in Super 35, because the Lauas only cover Super 35, whereas the 6K 4D only gives you 4K in Super 35. And maybe 4K is enough. 4K was enough on this last job. Maybe an A camera was a Alexa SXT. It was 3.2K. Like, maybe I don't care about Ks,
yeah.
But it does make me consider, like, do I do the 8K? I'm like thinking about it for that reason, because of all of that. But no, they're a constant 1.5 through the whole focus range, where, you know, and 1.5x on a 16x9 sensor still ends up giving you, you know, plenty of squeeze.
Yeah, like, that's enough. 1.3 isn't enough. There's a few that I've kind of been coming out that are 1.3, which I wouldn't waste my time with that. But 1.5 is enough.
Yeah, it's like a nice sweet spot where the out of focus bokeh has like a nice little gentle roll off. Honestly, also, you know, with any lens, I always got to talk about skin tone reproduction. I was really happy with skin tone reproduction here.
Nice.
I felt like it was like pleasantly flattering to the performer. Now, the one thing I do have to say is all of the action shots were one cyclist. I'm about to do two things in July with this setup that are like, one's a fashion thing. And like, you know, we've all fallen in that trap where we have like a particular lens lighting combo that's really good with one performer. And then like somebody else has a different head shape or like a different skin tone. And you're like, oh, fuck, yeah. That doesn't work.
Right.
Like I always think, apparently on this set of Return to Oz, Faiusa Balk was the star. And there was like a lens, the one movie Walter Murch directed. And there was like a lens where he was like,
I remember this story because I read that book. I just want to throw out there.
I'm George just made me jump, dude. I was like, whoa, George is back.
You know what's crazy?
I love that story because it was
That story waiting for George to be like, I know this. Like, yeah. I don't know how I knew you knew it, but I knew you knew it. And I was like, George is going to know this. I'm going to keep saying this until George jumps in.
We've been doing a podcast together for a million years. Yes.
I know. Okay.
I love that story, though. I've always loved it. Anyway, keep telling the story.
Like, you know, there are these things where like we think of lenses as being really like universal things, but it's like different lenses flatter different faces and like different lighting flatters different faces. And like, it's a very small percentage about different things that change for different people. And like, I did a lot of testing with one actor and I feel like you can learn a lot about how it reproduces faces with that one actor, but it could just be a beautiful combination of like these lenses and that actor. So I'm excited for more variety in July just to make sure my suspicions bear fruit. Sweet. I'm glad we talked about it some more. That's our first ever 2-week series of tech news. And I'm glad we did it because you had like all sorts of other questions.
Nice.
All right. Well, I'm on the internet at charleshain.com. I'm Charles Hain on Twitter and Instagram. I'm on YouTube at Charles Hain. That's where the Lawa Nanomorph thing is. It's also on the YouTube thing. And I do YouTube-y stuff, and I do this podcast, and I like bikes.
I'm on the internet at Lost in Graceland and on an internet website at ggHawkins.com.
I'm Todd Blankenship. I also do YouTube-y things at Am I a Filmmaker. Got a new video dropping this week.
And I'm George Edelman, editor-in-chief at No Film School. And this was a great one, guys. Thank you all for being here. I love it when we get this full crew together. You can find everything we talked about and more today at nofilmschool.com. Like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast. Leave us a comment. Let us know what you think. Email any questions to editor@nofilmschool.com, and we will try to answer them on air. And thank you so much for listening.